What happens when you give up Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon? Kashmir Hill from Gizmodo tells us how she survived.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Triangulation, episode 388, recorded February 25th, 2019, for March 8th, 2019. Kashmir Hill blocking the big five tech giants. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to some of the most interesting people working in tech today, writing about tech, thinking about tech, or doing massive investigative reports on tech. Today, my guest is Kashmir Hill. She is an investigative reporter at Gizmodo. Thanks for coming on, Kashmir.
My pleasure.
So you probably heard that Kashmir just did this giant, incredible reporting project where she gave up the five big tech companies. She lived without each one for a week and then spent a week without any of them. So mostly we'll talk about that. But before we get started, for people that might not have seen you on our previous shows or the interviews or don't follow your work, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your background. You didn't start as a tech reporter, right?
Yeah, I started out, I guess, as a legal reporter. When I first started publishing words online, I was an editor at Above the Law, which was kind of like the entity formerly known as Gawker for lawyers. And then I started writing about privacy, and I was writing about the intersection of privacy and law. And it just kind of forced me to start writing about technology.
And so you were pretty critical about technology, especially from a privacy perspective, from the beginning. But now that seems to be the course of most tech reporting now. How does it feel that people have finally like caught up to your reporting, which has always been a little bit like, let's take a look at how these companies are treating our privacy?
Well, I feel like I have many more competitors now. Who are looking to do negative stories about tech companies, and there didn't used to be as many people looking to do those stories. So I think overall, it's good because the tech companies have gotten, you know, very large and very powerful, and increasingly play like really important roles in all of our lives. So I'm glad there are a lot of people out there that are being watchdogs and doing critical reporting to show problems in society and hopefully helping the tech giants to fix them.
Okay, so the project, the six-week project, what gave you the idea to do this report?
One of the reasons I did it was that as a person who criticizes these companies a lot, kind of like every time I do a post about a bad thing that Facebook did or a bad thing that Google did, the response is always, well, if you don't like Facebook, just don't use their products. If you don't like Google, just, you know, stop using Google. And I wanted to interrogate whether that was possible. You know, if you are a critic of these companies and you don't want to use them anymore, is it possible to stop using their products and, you know, completely leave their ecosystems? And so, I came up with this project to that and found that, spoiler, it's not really possible to avoid the tech giants in your life, with the exception of Apple.
So when people, you know, I've heard it too, like, oh, I'll complain, you know, I'll talk about some kind of privacy issue that a company has, and people just, you know, will say, don't use it. But what you really did was you set out to make sure these companies didn't track you, didn't have any of your information, and also didn't monetize any of that information. How is that even possible?
Yeah. So reporters have done stories before where they said like, oh, I tried to go off, you know, Facebook. I tried to go off Google. It's very hard, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted to do something unique, something that hadn't been done before. And so I consulted with this technologist, Dhruv Mehrotra, and said, I want to do this story where I just cut all access to the tech giants. And do you know how I could do this? I don't want my devices to be able to talk to them at all. And so he went off and did a little research and came back to me and said, well, you know, all of the tech giants publish these lists of the IP addresses that they control. So I can just create a virtual private network for you that you'll connect all of your devices to and run your traffic through them. And I'll block your devices from being able to talk to the tech giant servers by just like blacklisting the IP addresses that they control. And it worked pretty well for most of the companies, though we did run into some hiccups, particularly with Amazon Web Services.
And so what's amazing is, I mean, you know, the people that say, look, well, I'm deleting my Facebook account, but I'm still using Instagram. Like, that's the highest level of like, well, you know, most of us, probably most people listening to this know that Facebook owns Instagram. But then there's the like, you know, the things you forgot about, like, oh, I can't use LinkedIn because they're owned by Microsoft, you know, or just like I can't use WhatsApp because they're owned by Facebook, like those little things. But then, I mean, what you learned was that there's just so many, like these, your devices were trying to ping these big five tech giants constantly.
Yeah. I mean, it varied from company to company, but, you know, even as I was blocking them and not using their services, you know, when I was blocking Google, like I wasn't going to Gmail anymore. I switched to a new email provider. I wasn't using google.com to do my searches, but my devices were continuing to try to interact with these companies for a lot of different reasons. With Amazon and with Google and with Microsoft, those three companies have web hosting services. So I was visiting websites that are hosted by them. So especially for Amazon, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, your audience knows this, but kind of normal people who are reading my piece just didn't know that AWS is, you know, the most profitable part of Amazon, and that they host just a vast majority of the websites and apps out there. And so I kept visiting sites that were on Amazon servers. So those would be blocked for me. You know, when I was trying to block Facebook, I kept running into various trackers around the web, Facebook Pixel, Facebook like buttons. With Google, you know, Google Maps is everywhere. They have a real monopoly on providing map services to apps and websites. So even though I was not using their products, I kept running into these companies because they provide so much of the infrastructure of the digital world.
And what's interesting is some of them are actual competitors. I'm not real competitors. I mean, we will talk about competition, but you were talking about how you download audiobooks from Access 360, the library app, which I do that too. And they're hosted by AWS. And you would think, I mean, since Amazon owns Audible, it's in their interest, you know, to make Access 360 slower. Like, I'm not saying, you didn't say they do that, and I'm not saying they do that. And I'm sure Amazon loves the libraries because it, you know, creates readers that will then buy their books later. But there, did you notice a lot of competitors in your research?
I mean, the direct competitor. I mean, so when I was blocking Amazon, it meant I gave up kind of like all digital entertainment because so many video providers rely on AWS. So, for example, Netflix, who is very much a direct competitor with Amazon Prime Video, they use AWS for their hosting. And so I couldn't use Netflix for that week. And that one did surprise me because Netflix and Amazon directly compete on offering entertainment, trying to get new subscribers. And what's actually funny to me is I find at home that Amazon Prime Video is terrible for streaming. It just, we always have like really bad quality video, whereas Netflix is much better. So it's funny that they're both hosted by AWS but have differing quality. And you would think, oh, that AWS would try to maybe sabotage Netflix or make their movies grainy, but it's the opposite in my experience.
Huh, that's interesting. So you started with Amazon. Why was Amazon the first company that you picked?
I picked Amazon first because I thought that it would be the hardest, honestly, and I figured I'd just start with the hardest. In part because we use Amazon so much in our household. We have an Echo. We both shop a lot on Amazon. Both my husband and I have Amazon Prime accounts and Amazon Prime credit cards. you know, we shop at Whole Foods. And then I knew that this Amazon Web Services was going to be a real challenge because Dhruv and I had done some testing before we started the experiment. And I was already seeing how many sites were taken down. So I thought, okay, I'll just, you know, I'll do the most challenging thing first and hopefully it'll be downhill from there in terms of how difficult it is.
I was actually surprised. I mean, just because you do cover privacy so much, I was surprised to know that you used so many, like you had Echoes in your house. I mean, I have them covering my house. It made me feel better that I have them, that you had them.
But, I feel ashamed to admit that we have an Echo, especially because both my husband and I work in the kind of privacy and security space. But it was my husband who got it for me 2 years ago when we had our first child. He thought, oh, it would be nice to have a way, like a hands-free way to get music and set timers. And honestly, we use the Echo for that a lot. You know, I think this is part of the paradox that we're in, that we do want these services, we do want these new technologies, but we don't really like the privacy trade-offs involved. And it seems like I should be able to get a smart speaker that, you know, sets timers for me and provides music to me without having to give up all this data to a company like Amazon. So yeah, I do hope that we start seeing some more privacy-respective products come online, because I would definitely prefer to buy that.
And you also know, I mean, because you do research and you talk to these people, you know that some of what people complain about or some of the headlines you might see are overblown a little bit. Like the whole thing that I'm sure we've talked about before, where everyone says Facebook is listening to you. And, you know, the truth is they're not actually listening to what you're saying, but the way they're tracking you is much more insidious.
Right, right. They know enough about you that they can predict what you're going to talk about, which is almost scarier than them listening all the time.
So does that then feel like make you feel a little bit better about having like the Amazon Echoes in your house? Because I don't know, does it make you feel better? Because that's how I feel sometimes. It's like, well, you might as well give up.
Yeah, I don't want anyone to feel like they might as well give up. Like, I hate that as a conclusion. So no, I still remain embarrassed that we have an Echo. And we will probably switch at some point, but our daughter really, really loves it. And yeah, she goes back and forth. Sometimes she'll say that, I hate to say the word because it's gonna make Echo start talking, but sometimes she'll say like Echo is scary, and other times she says, especially during this experiment, that she missed Echo. So anyways, the way that we expose our kids to these technologies is so complicated, and honestly, since my daughter is only two, I feel like I'm still figuring that part out.
Yeah, and I mean, that is, you did a video for the whole series, which is amazing. I recommend reading and watching the whole series on Gizmodo. But yeah, it opens basically with your daughter screaming to that device in our home, so that I won't scream her name. But so, do you think of Amazon as different? I mean, especially before 2015, when the Amazon Echoes came out, when they came out with Amazon Voice Services, I really always thought of Amazon as different from a privacy perspective, whereas I always felt like there was something inherently wrong with the fact that Facebook was monetizing, like, the pictures of my kids, or, you know, if I made a vulnerable post that I wanted to, you know, people to see, just my Facebook friends, that they were using that, the feeling and emotion to sell ads to me. Whereas Amazon, it seemed like a more of a trade-off. It's like, well, I'm buying this kind of toilet paper, you know, recommend the other things you might think that I would buy if I bought that kind of toilet paper. And that felt somehow better. Do you agree with that? Or do you think they're all kind of, these two companies are equal from a privacy perspective?
No, from a privacy perspective, I think it's different. I mean, I think Facebook, as much as they say that they're not in the business of selling users' data, Facebook is in the business of selling access to users' data. You know, the business model is, we know a lot about people. We're not going to sell it to you directly, though they have, it's coming out that they thought about doing that. They have, you know, this big database of people, and they're letting advertisers know certain things about those people in order to display ads to them. So Facebook's not giving away the data for the most part. They're, you know, letting advertisers have access to users based on what they know about them. So it is, you know, Facebook is ultimately in the data business. And Amazon is different. You know, they make their money from one hosting much of the web, much of the data that we get digitally, and through their retail business. So they're not as directly in the business of monetizing their users' data. So I do think that they're different. Though it's becoming clear that Amazon is really good at crunching data and using its insights to enter new businesses and to put pressure on competitors. One of the kind of interesting stories I ran into while I was working on this project is a couple of years back, there were people that were trying to like leave reviews on books on Amazon, and Amazon would tell them, sorry, you can't leave this review because we know that you know the author of the book. And in one case, this woman said, like, I don't know the author of the book. I don't know why Amazon thinks that I know her. And Amazon wouldn't tell her why. And it was kind of this mystery. And then it came out recently that Amazon had kind of special access to data on Facebook, about Facebook users. And it seemed pretty clear that Amazon was getting information about social networks and who knew who on Facebook. And so I went back to this author, to this woman whose review had been banned. And she said, oh, yeah, I was following that author's Facebook page. So somehow Amazon was absorbing that information from Facebook, that this woman was following the author on Facebook, and took that to mean that they knew each other personally. So Amazon does use lots of data. I think it's more like large scale kind of like economic business data, but they're also getting data about individuals, and they're using it as part of their business. But yeah, it's not the primary thing that they're trying to exploit in the way that it is the primary thing for Facebook.
That's just such a crazy story, because like they're doing it for the right reasons, right? Like you would like to know that it wasn't someone's mom who's giving a great review of the novel you're about to read. But then it's sort of nefarious the way they're doing it.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I think that the most uncomfortable thing about the world that we live in today is that it's just increasingly becoming this commercial panopticon. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, we're being surveilled for legitimate reasons, but it's just like constantly happening with every possible human interaction that can be digitized in some way. And I just think it's really starting to make us kind of paranoid as a society, and just uncomfortable, because we don't know what data is being collected or what data is being used to make decisions, or when we're being observed and when we're not being observed, and how it will come back to haunt us. And that just seems to be the state of things right now. And so I've been writing about privacy for 10 years, so it's not a surprise to me, but it just feels like more and more data is being collected because there's just more and more sensors out there. And because more of our interactions are digitized now, because we use so many of these products. And it kind of comes back to this Tech Giant series. It's just that they have pushed so much technology into our lives that it's kind of between us and other people and a lot of the things that we do.
Mm-hmm. And so you had Dhruv created the VPN for you so he would know when your devices were pinging these companies. And in the case of Amazon, your devices pinged them 300,000 times in the week, I guess. And he said sometimes it was pinging in the middle of the night. Do you know, did you figure out why, what it was trying to do in the middle of the night?
Yes. I'm pretty sure the late night pings, he's on the East Coast, so it's middle of the night to him. But for me, it was 10 or 11 p.m. at night. So that's when I was opening my Access 360 app to read, I think I was reading the Wheel of Time series during this experiment. And so I would open it up to read before I went to bed. And so we figured out. So I stopped using the app once we realized that it was sending data to Amazon. But, otherwise that wasn't visible to me. I just had this library app where I check out books and I read them in the app. And I had no idea that Amazon was involved, and I later found out Microsoft was involved too. You know, that's just where these tech giants are kind of in the invisible infrastructure of the internet. And so I needed Dhruv's help to make those kinds of interactions visible.
Okay, so the second week was Facebook. And again, just like I'm comforted that you have an Amazon Echo, I'm also comforted that you use Instagram, as I do. And
my account is private.
Yeah, mine is not. I guess that's something I can consider doing. But I can't give it up. Like, I just, and I like it. Like, I don't feel like there's any, you know, it's like when I go to Facebook, I just kind of feel bad and I don't really enjoy it very much. And I'm also on Instagram because my kids are on Instagram and I want to see what they're doing. And they also have accounts that I can't see what they're doing. And that's okay, too. Let's talk about Facebook. What was the hardest thing about giving up Facebook for the week?
Yeah. So unlike Amazon, Facebook wasn't as technically challenging to block. And so we did effectively block all of my connections to Facebook. It was hard. I mean, there's one friend, basically only one friend at this point that I talked to on WhatsApp. She lives abroad. And so I just couldn't talk to her during the week because it's the only way that we communicate. But more challenging was Instagram has become kind of my go-to place for sharing social news and learning social news. Facebook as well, but less so. And so I found that I was just kind of cut off from my social network, and I just didn't have a way to kind of mass share news. I had a close friend, one of my closest friends actually, who had her baby the week I was blocking Facebook, and I didn't find out about it until later when I re-enabled my Facebook account, and the first thing that was at the top of my newsfeed was that my friend had her baby. And so I called her and I said, "Hey, congratulations, I'm so happy for you. I didn't realize that you'd given birth." And she said, "Well, you know, if I post something to Facebook, I just assume that everybody I know sees it." And that's something I just kept running into, that people now, because we're all on, I mean, honestly, my whole social network is on Facebook, and people just assume that if you share news there, you don't have to text it or call somebody or email them, that they'll just see it. And so I basically was cut out of that world. And I had to do a lot more communicating by text message. I tried email, but I just find that no one uses email anymore.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the entire piece. I think that was what I found so fascinating and useful about it. I mean, you are you have, like you said, been a security and privacy reporter for 10 years. You know this stuff, but you also have a very strong physical network of people around you, and also, you know, people that you have to use technology to connect to. Your reporter, so you said, you know, you couldn't use Signal because they're backed by AWS, and that's how you contact sources. And you come to this conclusion that I've never heard anyone write about, but that using the technology disconnects you from the people around you. But then when you don't use it, you're suddenly disconnected from the people who aren't immediately around you. And so, I mean, just talk about that a little bit. That was the part of the piece that moved me the most.
Yeah, So a couple of months before I did this experiment, I had gone to visit some college friends who live on the East Coast. I live in California, and their two friends, you know, my best friends from college, every week we send text messages to each other. We usually have photos of the week, and we just talk about what happened that week. And so I felt like this is something that we had established to be in better contact with each other. And I went to visit them, and I was talking to my one friend, and there were just all these things that were happening in her life, like really big emotional stuff that it was not something that she was going to put into these, you know, picture text messages that we sent around over the course of the week. And so I had to be with her in person to catch up about this. And so I came away from that experience being like, oh, you know, we think that the tech is keeping us in good touch with people, but there's so much communication that's left out of sending pictures around or doing status updates. And then I did this experiment and didn't have that technology and also felt left out. Like I didn't know what was happening with my friends. You know, they are just out of the habit of telling me. People like put things in Instagram stories and Instagram photos and on Facebook that is supposed to let you know what's going on in their life. And so while I'm in touch with people technologically, I feel like I'm not getting as much information as I needed. And then when I was cut off from it, I also felt like I wasn't getting the information I needed to be in touch with people. So I feel in this really, and I think society in general is in this terrible position right now where I just wonder if we're really communicating well with each other, and what's getting left out when we're just sending each other. So much of our communication is digitized now. It's text, it's pictures. I don't know how fully we are in touch with one another. And I don't have a good place to land there. But I wonder, I don't know whether we just need to talk to each other more. Like we need to bring phone calls back from the dead.
Yeah, totally. But then you have your friend that's abroad, and that, I mean, I guess that's what the WhatsApp. But then you have to use Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things I did as part of this is I had to. So I cut Apple out of my life. It was near the end of my experiment. I was about to cut them all, so I didn't want to just go from the iPhone to an Android. So I was trying to find a phone that wasn't, you know, made or touched by Apple or Google, and that was really hard because Apple and Google via Android basically have a duopoly on the smartphone market. So I couldn't find a commercially available smartphone that wasn't made by either of them. So I ended up going back to Nokia 3310, which was re-released in 2017. And it was basically like a feature phone or a dumb phone where it just had, you know, like the number keypad and you do T9 texting. It had like a very basic Opera browser, but it was very, very slow. And I would have to be, you know, putting in search terms by T9 texting, which is, you know, you hit the one button three times to get a C, which is excruciating. And when I did this, it basically, I discovered how hard it was to export my contacts from Apple to the Nokia. And so it was this really involved process where I went into the iCloud, had to narrow down the list, export that list, plug my Nokia into the computer, move a file over. And the Nokia only holds, I think, like 200 contacts. So I whittled down my Apple contacts from over 1,500 people to a list of the people I actually talked to. And it ended up being 143 people. And so it just made me realize, like, I did the same thing I saw on Google I had over 8,000 contacts, but it made me realize like I'm in touch or I have the ability to be in touch with thousands of people, but I'm only really capable of being in touch with 143 people, which was a funny number because it was essentially Dunbar's number of 150, which is this British sociologist who studied all kinds of, you know, human groups and determined that 150 people is the number of people that we can kind of cope with and truly know and recognize their faces and have kind of a functioning society with them. So it made me realize that technology makes us able to be in touch with thousands of people, but we are only really equipped to be in touch with and really know 150 people. So maybe it's why we all feel so overwhelmed and why we're not effectively communicating with people because we're just in touch with too many people.
I think about that all the time. I mean, when Facebook first came out, and it was when I had just had a baby, and I remember like connecting with all these people, and many of them also just had babies, and they were people that I had not been connected with for maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe longer. And, you know, and it was before you really thought about what you posted on Facebook. So there was just a lot of people posting things that made me realize they were probably, a lot of them were suffering from postpartum depression, but, and I would just feel so bad because there was like, you know, dozens millions of them, and there's no way that I could, you know, and it was just, it hurt too much to think about it. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. We're not, you know, we're not set up to have that many people in our lives that we want to take care of, that we can take care of, and it just causes anxiety. So yeah, it's, I thought that was so interesting, that Dunbar's number, that that's what the Nokia holds. I think it was Kevin Roos's piece, that, cause he was just trying to give up his phone too. And then Kevin in the New York Times, but forgive me if it was yours, where he says, like, he makes the idea that eventually, like, we might all evolve. Our brains might evolve so that we are better at communicating this way, but right now we're not. Was that you or was that Kevin who said that?
I actually don't remember that being in either piece. I just read Kevin's piece. Yeah, this is Kevin.
Okay, maybe it was just someone else just saying that, yeah, eventually our brains might evolve, you know, a billion years from now so that we can connect to people. But we're not now. And I do see that. I see that with, like, when I struggle with my teenagers, like, you know, you got to, you know, communicate face to face. You got to, but like, that is their, you know, Snapchat is their face to face, and it's so hard. But okay, so let's move on to Google.
The most interesting thing in Kevin's piece, and I experienced this as well, is, you know, as a result of this whole experiment, I just am using technology less and have been really good about using my smartphone less because the Nokia kind of broke me of all these habits. And when you start using your phone less, which is what Kevin's piece is all about, like detoxing himself, you have a lot more free time because you're not looking at your smartphone. And so you spend more time looking around or being present with the people that you're with. But it's hard because those people are not often present with you because they're looking at their smartphones. So I think the hardest part about, you know, using your smartphone less is that you notice that everyone else is totally absorbed in theirs. And I hope that we can change this because I find it so disturbing now when I'm just looking around and just everyone is staring down at a screen, especially when you're like at a family gathering and you're, the whole point is to be together. And it's just that hard to let go of, you know, the digital world that this thing represents.
Yeah, I tried to do an hour, like it was a practice to do a whole hour without screens every day. I did that, you know, baby steps. And I found that, like, I came down on a Saturday morning and, you know, my kids, like, they noticed that I wasn't on my phone, even though they all have phones. And then it turned into this great conversation because they were like, oh, well, I'm going to try that, you know, and it's all like, I do think it'll change. Like, even they're cognizant of using too many devices. I'm sure you already see it in your family. Like, your daughter probably gets annoyed when you're using devices, and you get annoyed when she wants, you know, doesn't want to give the iPad back to you. Like, we all get annoyed, right? And then we all do it. And so I think there's, yeah, something's got to give. So Google, you said that it screwed up everything giving up Google.
Yeah, so Google was hard in part. You know, they're not the massive web host that Amazon is, but it did take a few. It took a few websites down for me. But the bigger problem was that just Google is all over the internet. Like, every single page had some kind of Google element to it, and most of the page. The way my VPN worked is that we wanted to capture the attempts to interact. So we would let a website like try to load a Google element, and then we just wouldn't let it connect to the server. So because of the way it worked, anytime I was on a website with Google elements, it just would take forever for the website to load, and it did seem like a lot of sites try to load content from Google before their own content. They were trying to load like Google's ads and trackers and analytics before they would even load their own content. And much of the web uses something called Google Fonts, which is a tool that Google designed to actually help websites load faster. And so it would store a whole bunch of a font library, you know, like in the browser so that websites can load faster rather than trying to look for that font library from your computer. But it had the opposite effect for me when I was blocking Google. And then I just found that the use of Google Maps is just ubiquitous, such that when, you know, I was trying to use Uber and Lyft one day to get to a meeting, and the apps wouldn't even work when I was blocking Google because they couldn't load Google Maps. So I couldn't enter a destination address in to say where I was going. And I ran into that again and again. I found that Yelp, which is a known critic of Google, really kind of an enemy of Google in that they're very upset about the way that Google sends traffic off of Google.com and, you know, privileges Google's results over Yelp's and tries to keep people kind of gives them information about, you know, restaurants or destinations within the kind of Google.com search instead of sending them to Yelp, and has been pushing for investigations into Google around the world. When I went to Yelp.com to look for a restaurant to go to for lunch one day, the map wouldn't load because they're using Google Maps. So I just like kept finding again and again that just the internet world depends on Google for so many things. And so it just kind of either made apps not work or just slowed down the internet for me, such that I felt like I was kind of back in the 1990s when I basically first got online. And, you know, I'd be like surfing via AOL on dial-up internet, and I would try to, I think I used to always go to the, I was a big fan of Silverchair in high school, and so I'd be trying to go to the Silverchair fan page, and I would have a book, and I'd be there reading the book, waiting for the website to load. That was my experience when I was blocking Google for a week.
So do you continue to use Firefox or DuckDuckGo, the replacements that you used, or are you back to Google?
Yeah, I still have DuckDuckGo on as my search of choice on my iPhone, which I am using an iPhone again, and I am still using Firefox actually. I think on my work computer, it's, you know, Google pays, I think, billions of dollars to be the default search engine for a lot of different browsers. And so on my work computer, when I downloaded Firefox, it like defaulted back to Google. And I have to say, Google search is just, it's a really good search product. And yeah, I haven't changed it off of it on my work computer because I do think Google works really well.
What about Proton Mail? Is that something you've continued to use?
Yeah. I mean, One of the discoveries of this experiment was just that I get so much email and so much junk. It's so hard to wade through my inbox. They just are. It's just a pile up. And so I started using Proton Mail basically for my important conversations. And it's just an easier way for me to see something as soon as it comes in. So I ended up paying for Proton Mail for the year. It was, I think, 48 euros. So I figure I should keep using it and make the most of it.
Well, that's another thing that you point out, just that privacy takes time and it takes money. And like, you can avoid a lot of this stuff, but it, and so what do you make of that? I mean, because you don't want people to be cut off. You don't want it to be, you know, just something that the rich can have. But I don't know how many 40 euros is. I don't know if that, how much that costs in, in dollars, but, you know,
it's about $50.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not that much, but I mean, people are probably not that many people are going to use that. So, I mean, what do you make of that? The fact that you have to pay for privacy. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
I mean, this is a huge problem. This is something, there's a new book by a Harvard business professor, Shoshana Zuboff. It's called In the Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And it's about just the rise of this method of monetizing the internet, that, you know, everything was free and that we pay for our data and what that really looks like for us. And that's a model that spread even to services that charge us, like a lot of the phone carriers, even though we're paying up to $100 or more per month, they are still gathering data about the websites we go to, our location data, you know, what we're looking at, and they do these like aggregated anonymized reports that they'll sell to advertisers. So they're making money off of people's data, even though their customers are paying them for the service. But yeah, it's just this like big problem that, and it's a problem in journalism. I mean, most sites are free, and the payoff is that we have ads all over those sites. And in advertising online now, sometimes it's about ads, but a lot of times it's just about tracking people's behavior and what they're looking at and building these data profiles to then theoretically offer better ads. And so we have just created this internet where things are, you know, free and are there's a whole business model that's just built on data profiling and data brokering. And so I think about that a lot, writing about privacy and what that means for the future. And, you know, one possibility, if we do want to have more privacy online, is that maybe we would be paying for things more often so that the services we use don't have to monetize our data because we're actually subscribers. And we aren't even given that option a lot of times. We're not given the option to have, a premium journalism account or a journalism subscription, for example, where you're not shown ads. That's not an option on every single site. So I just don't know if that'll be the solution, right? To get away from a model of surveillance capitalism, will we just pay for more things online instead of paying with our data? But if we did go that way, we immediately run into some really big issues, which is that people who can afford to pay will have privacy online, but people who are poor, people who are the most vulnerable will be the ones that can't afford this and then have to pay with their data. So then that means that the most vulnerable people continue to have their data exploited. So I don't really like that as the solution to this problem, but it is something I think about a lot.
And it might already be happening to some extent. I mean, there's research like that, you know, if you search certain things on Google, you're not going to get, you know, the same loans as other. I mean, our data, if you're already vulnerable, it's already happening to you that the lack of privacy is going to hit people that are poor first, probably, whether we're paying for sites or not.
I think you see it a little bit with iPhone versus Android. I mean, it seems like we keep seeing stories about the smartphone apps that are gathering data about people. And a lot of times it seems to be happening more with Android than with iPhone, because iPhone is basically a better policed, not perfectly policed, but a better policed app store environment. And iPhones are more expensive. So people who are buying iPhones are kind of getting more privacy built into the experience than people who are buying Android smartphones, which tend to be cheaper. So I think that's a place where we're already seeing you get more privacy if you pay more.
Right. I mean,
that's a big generalization, but I think that it is generally true.
Right. And I mean, you can get an even super cheap Android phone, you know, and they're really like, you know, and they'll send all your data back to China, but you can get a $10 phone. So yeah, I think that's for sure happening. Your piece on Microsoft, so you gave up Microsoft for a week, and that was really interesting because you use that as an opportunity to look at the antitrust cases of the 90s and whether we might be dealing with something completely different if those hadn't happened. So talk a little bit about your week without Microsoft.
Yeah, so I thought Microsoft would be really easy because I had a hard time thinking what Microsoft products I still use. I don't use Microsoft Office. I mostly use Google Docs now. I don't have Outlook email. I haven't had that in years. I use Gmail for personal, and we used Google Enterprise at work. So I was just having a hard time thinking of Microsoft products I even use. And so I thought, there was this big antitrust investigation into Microsoft in the 90s, and maybe that created this possibility for me that I can get away from Microsoft because the government cracked down on them in the 90s. I think it's actually not quite that simplistic because there are definitely Microsoft services I use, like what we're using right now to talk. I use Skype all the time and it's owned by Microsoft. I use LinkedIn a lot. It's a great reporting tool. Microsoft bought that one. I don't use it as much, but GitHub, Microsoft basically bought all the workhorses of social media that people use to get work done. And I kept running into Microsoft out in the world in ways that I couldn't see and that the VPN couldn't stop, because Microsoft servers are so widely used by governments and corporate clients. It's still a huge and valuable company. It just isn't, it doesn't interface as much directly with consumers. And so it's possible for me to get away from it. If I used the train here in San Francisco, the BART, they use Microsoft's technology for their back end technology services. So I couldn't totally escape it, but it was a good opportunity to just look back and see what happens when the government actually thinks that a technology company is getting too big and is, you know, thwarting competitors in a way that hurts consumers. And it was interesting to look back at that big case. It was the Department of Justice and, you know, 20 attorneys general from around the country decided Microsoft was doing bad things. The kind of thing that we most talk about from that era is Netscape Navigator was a free browser for the newly, it wasn't free actually, sorry, it cost $50 for most people. It was free in some cases, like for students and academics or nonprofits, but a new browser for surfing the newly born internet. And Microsoft had a real stranglehold on the computer industry because it was the operating system used by most computers. And so Microsoft said to computer makers, like, you're using our operating system, you need to include our free Internet Explorer as a way to kind of crush Netscape Navigator. And so government investigated. It was this long, drawn-out process. And Microsoft eventually wasn't broken up, which is what the government originally wanted, but did agree to, you know, basically, like, not actively try to crush all of its competitors. And it gave space for companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook to grow. And it was just interesting to look back at that case because it did seem like a lot of what the government objected to are what is happening today with those then, you know, new little saplings that are now huge trees in the tech forest that are, threatening the growth of new saplings. It was interesting to see that since then the government hasn't really cracked down on any technology company, even though they've gotten so big and moved into so many other industries. The five companies that I blocked over the last decade have bought something like more than 400 other companies. Big ones that, like Facebook buying Instagram, Facebook buying WhatsApp, and regulators have not pushed back on any of those or really done any kind of antitrust investigations in the United States. And so it was surprising looking back at the Microsoft case that was the case, just because some of what's happening now looks similar to what was happening with Microsoft back then.
Absolutely. And even when you think about like Apple, which comes out looking pretty good from your investigation, but even them, you can only buy iPhone apps from the App Store and they take 30% of it and there's no other way to get apps. And their answer is like, we'll just get an Android phone, which I guess is right now like passes muster, but who knows if it will.
Future. Apple is lucky that they have relatively small market share because I think they don't get as much antitrust scrutiny as a result.
Okay, so let's move on to Apple. You described that experience as devastating.
Yeah, Apple is hard because I don't know when this happened, but somewhere along the way I became kind of like a Mac head where I use an iPhone. I have various MacBooks. I use a MacBook Pro for work, a MacBook Air for my personal. And when I first thought about doing this experiment, I was talking to Gizmodo's editors about it. I was like, well, I think I should block the big tech companies, but I don't think I should block Apple because, you know, they're pretty much like a good guy. Like, people aren't usually mad at Apple. And also, I don't know how I'd do it because Apple is my gateway to the internet. Like, I'd have to get all new devices. And they were like, yes, you'll have to do that. So it was just hard because I'm so used to using Apple devices, and it was just challenging to use non-Apple devices because I've been using Apple for so long. It was just kind of like I've been driving a certain kind of car for 5 years, and then I had to adjust to another one. And it was funny to get out of, it was hard to get out of the Apple ecosystem in those kinds of ways, just in terms of adapting to new devices, but also because, like with iMessaging, a lot of my friends also have iPhones, and I found that Apple didn't want to let me go. And it was hard just to get out of iMessage. So I started, you know, I got this Nokia 3310 and I was texting people and they weren't responding to me. And I was trying to figure out what was going on. And then I realized that Apple was routing the text responses back to my Apple devices. And so, and even after I turned off iMessaging, I still wasn't getting some group messages, just because it seemed like it was confusing the wires. It was interesting to get out of the Apple ecosystem just because it made me realize how annoying Apple is about so many things. Like, it was so hard to get my contacts out of Apple and onto an Android phone or onto the Nokia. Just realizing how stuck you are in the way that Apple designs its products, where nothing is compatible. Like when I started using this laptop from a company called Purism, it's a Linux laptop. It just has like standardized ports that just work of everything. Like all other non-Apple devices kind of like have standard cords and chargers and it all works together no matter which device you're using. Whereas with Apple, it's like the new computer only has Thunderbolt ports and I have to get a dongle if I want to be able to plug a USB thing into it. It's just insane when you realize the kind of capture. I mean, the fact that my new iPhone doesn't have a headphone jack is insane to me, forcing you to get like AirPods. They just like force you to get more and more Apple stuff. And so that was annoying. But what's funny is that once you leave, Apple is done with you. Apple did not try to track me. I wasn't pinging Apple servers. The for that week, I interacted with Apple about 15,000 times, but most of it was just the first day because I was having so much trouble getting my new devices up and running that I had to keep using my Apple computer and my iPhone, and so it kind of artificially inflated the numbers. During the last week, once I'd freed myself from Apple, during the course of that week, I only pinged Apple 36 times over the whole week, which is so small compared to the other ones. I mean, basically, once you're out of Apple's ecosystems, once you don't use an Apple device, Apple is no longer tracking you. And so that was reassuring. That was the only tech giant that stopped trying to track me or collect my data or interact with me when I gave it up.
Yeah, that is so interesting, because like the rest of the companies are like very desperate and thirsty and Apple's like, don't let the door hit you on the way out, basically.
Exactly.
Because we don't, I mean, and it is sort of reverse psychology. Like, we do buy AirPods and we do buy the dongles and we do go back to iPhones so that we don't, you know, we remain the blue bubble to impress our friends. And you know, they have set it up in a way where no other company has figured that out. Like, I mean, you're right. It is a small market share. I'm not talking, you know, obviously everybody doesn't go back to Apple, but they seem fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be making lots of money the way that they're doing things. But yeah, I felt like this kind of stigma for not having, especially not having the iPhone, because I would be texting with friends and they'd be like, why is your bubble green? Like, what's the matter? Where's your iPhone? Are you traveling? And a friend of mine, the same friend who had the baby, I wanted to talk to her and she's like, I want to FaceTime you so that you can, you know, see the baby crying. And I said, well, I can't FaceTime. Can we do Google Chat? And she's like, I don't know. Or can we do Google Hangout or use Skype? She's like, I don't know what that is. Just, when are you going to get your iPhone back?
Yes, I have. Jason Howell and I switch phones every January, and I take his Android phone. And it is very hard for people to understand that change. So I want to talk a little bit more about the Librem 13 from Purism. Is that a computer that you would recommend to someone?
Yeah, it actually, I mean, it worked really well. It's expensive. It's kind of an Apple level price tag. I think the model I was using is $1,300, but it had some really cool things. They confused me before I got used to them, but it has a switch to turn off your camera and your mic, which is kind of cool for people that are worried about the fact that we increasingly have all these devices around us that have cameras and mics built into them. So if you're worried about the fact that your computer might be listening to you, you can just turn it off and only have the mic and camera on when you want to use them. So that was cool. And it was kind of fun to get out of the ecosystem. And the company is it's a social purpose company based here in California, and they were the perfect company to use for this experiment because they basically came into creation as a liberate your data kind of movement in wanting to help people get away from the tech giants. And so everything is open source and interoperable. The founder was telling me about all the services I can use instead of those ones offered by the tech giant. And I discovered, you know, other video chat apps where you don't even have to create an account or have a password. You just can use them. And it basically helped introduce me to this world of, just the, I don't know what to call them, the open source software movement, the digital vegans, just people who want the internet to be kind of what it was first imagined to be, where it's not proprietary, it's not centralized, and you have the ability to communicate with whoever you want without having a corporate giant as an intermediary.
And that's expensive.
And yeah, it's expensive. I mean, part of the reason it's expensive is that they're a small company, so they don't have the same kind of like established supply lines so that they can make their devices more cheaply. So I think the people that buy them will have to be people who are, you know, really passionate about privacy. They also have a lot of security. I mean, it's not what I was interested in, but they have a lot of security features that are built into it, like a special key that you can use to ensure that no one has tampered with your computer while you've been away from it. You know, the whole thing is encrypted. It's definitely like a very secure device. But I think part of the reason why you would get it would be for kind of ethical reasons. Mm-hmm. It took me just a few days to get used to it, kind of like driving a new car. But once I did it, it worked really well for me. And it's cool. It's just it's all black. They had to paint it black because it's made from raw aluminum like a MacBook, but you can't make a computer out of raw aluminum anymore because it looks like an Apple computer. they didn't have their device. They didn't have their logo on the back of the computer like an Apple does. They're all about kind of just like minimalism and kind of like anti-corporate. And it's a cool little company.
Is it also made from like conflict-free materials? Is that part of their thing or no?
I don't know. Might be. I don't know.
Okay. So then the last week that you gave up everything, you couldn't listen to anything. You couldn't be entertained. You had to be alone with your own thoughts. That sounds terrifying. How was that week?
Yeah, that week was, it's a while ago now. So I did this experiment a couple months ago. That was, this was in December, and, it was a quiet week. What I found is that the tech giants, like those big five companies that I was blocking, are just woven into the services of so many other companies. Like they are part of the infrastructure of the web. They've built the roads and the highways and the services online. And so when you're blocking the tech giants, there's just a lot of the web and technology that you just can't use. So it was a week without a lot of technology. It made, I was getting ready for a trip to South Africa for a story that I was doing, and I couldn't, book my ticket online. I couldn't do any really a lot of online research. So I had to call the travel agency that Gizmodo Media Group uses and talk to them about flights and hotels. And it kind of felt like a return to the 90s in a lot of ways, because it was just like much of the internet just wasn't available to me. And the biggest kind of lifestyle change is that I was using this dumb phone, this Nokia phone that only calls and text, essentially. So when I was driving or walking or not sitting in front of a computer, I was away from the internet. And so if you wanted to get in touch with me, you had to text me or call me. I wasn't going to be checking emails or looking at Slack. And so in that way, it was frustrating, but it was also freeing. And I also found texting just really annoying because of the T9 texting. So I was calling people a lot and they would always pick up right away, usually like asking, are you okay? What's going on? Because I never call anybody. and it's nice to do calls. I don't know. You just get more information when you talk to people. I didn't take many photos, one because the quality on the Nokia camera was so bad, but also because I didn't have anywhere to really post them without Facebook or Instagram. And I found that I wasn't as adventurous in terms of like seeking out new places, especially if I was driving, because life without mapping apps is pretty hard. So I just drove to places that I knew and didn't kind of go to new places. So it kind of like limits your ability to explore. I do recognize a lot of the benefits of these tech companies. I love having mapping apps. I love that I can travel to really any city in the world without doing any research. You can just land and then start looking things up on your smartphone app. You can, you know, call an Uber in most cities around the world. You can figure out which restaurants to go to. And by blocking the tech giants, you lose access to those kinds of services. I had a very frustrating thing happen where I'd booked something on Airbnb and got locked out and realized I like couldn't get the code for the door without being able to log into Airbnb, which I couldn't do because Airbnb is hosted by AWS. And I was just really wanting my smartphone back because it's hard to be in an emergency and not have access to the internet. It was a mixed bag. On the last day of that final block, we were flying from California to New York, and my husband was saying, you have got to give up the experiment early because we're going to have our 2-year-old on that plane for 6 hours and we need to use the iPad, because otherwise how are we going to keep her happy on the flight? Usually we download movies and then we'll let her like, you know, watch Moana or Monsters, Inc. or whatever she's obsessed with. But I was holding really firm and saying, I don't want to break early. I want to try to do this flight without the tech giants. And I ended up reading books with her. We like played with these little swizzle sticks that came in her Alaska Airlines meal that were just like sticky sticks that you could stick to paper and make figures out of. We sang songs. She ended up napping for the last hour and a half of the flight, which she usually never does if there's an iPad there to stimulate her. And it went really well. And we landed and got into the taxi. And my husband Trevor turned to me and said, that was actually the easiest flight we've ever had with her. And so it just made me, you know, question some of our reliance on tech giants, some of the things that we think we need. It was like a detox. And I came away from it really able to recognize some bad tech habits that I had developed. And, it's been a couple of months now since I did the experiment, and I haven't backslid too much. I really am using my smartphone much less. I deleted apps that I just was using. I mean, like gaming apps, like Words with Friends. I had like a Hearts app I like to play while I watch TV. And I'm just not second screening anymore. And just not looking at my phone as much. I just feel more present as a parent. It was a really good thing for me. I feel like most people would benefit from doing some kind of tech detox, maybe not as extreme as mine, but it was a good way to recognize bad things that I was doing with technology and try to eliminate those things from my life.
Well, Kashmir, that is amazing. Love that story of the flight. You're like a pioneer woman on the flight. so inspiring. Check out the piece. There's so much more that we didn't cover. So many great videos. Check it out on Gizmodo. You can find it by searching Kashmir on Twitter or just going to Gizmodo. You'll find it. We'll also link in the show notes of this story. But is there anything else that you're working on that I know you... you're constantly posting privacy stories and there's no end of fodder, but what are you working on, a book, anything you can talk about?
I'd love to do a book. I kind of I've felt like I encountered so many issues reporting on the tech giants. I'd love to do a book about these things. So I'm thinking about that. But other than that, this was an exhausting series to do. And I'm heading to Hawaii next week on vacation. And hopefully we'll not have to use the iPad on the flight with my daughter. But yeah, just looking forward to getting away from it all for a little while.
No shame if you have to. No judgment, no shame. But yeah, that's great. Well, thank you. Now that if you've given up Hearts and Words with Friends, then you might have time to write a book. That's what I always think. That
true.
Kashmir Hill, she is an investigative reporter at Gizmodo. She is at Cash Hill, KASHHILL on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Megan.
And thank you for joining us. Triangulation records every Friday-ish. We're on every Friday. You can find us in your podcast catcher. Just subscribe to Triangulation. Go to twit.tv/try and subscribe, and you'll get us whenever we come out. And thanks for watching, and we'll see you next week.